This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, March 5, 2004. At WBAI New York, I'm Amma Nsiabwadi, sitting in for Deepa Fernandez. Unions denounce outsourcing of jobs. Pro-choice organisations seek a permanent injunction to the Partial Birth Abortion Act. And workers in Immokalee march against Taco Bell's business practices.
It's really a struggle about all the working poor, whether it is in Canada or United States or Mexico, who have been displaced because of free trade agreements.
But first, these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. The Iraqi constitutional signing ceremony collapsed today when five Shiite members of the U.S.-appointed Iraqi Governing Council walked out over the issue of Kurdish autonomy. Aaron Glantz reports from Arbil, Iraq.
The Kurdish people carved an autonomous area out of northern Iraq, and their leaders want to keep it intact. Many Kurds want to go even further. Last week, activists traveled to Baghdad with a petition signed by 1.7 million Kurds demanding a referendum on Kurdish independence. At the same time, the organization Human Rights Watch slammed the interim constitution for denying women equal rights to inherit, divorce, and marry. Sharkriya Harmadian of the Kurdistan Women's Union says the constitution keeps in place laws imposed by Saddam Hussein.
When a woman wants to divorce her husband, it's controlled by the brothers and the fathers. And sometimes when women want to marry, they were not able to say what they want. It was controlled by their father, and sometimes even by the courts. Sometimes a judge will ask for their father. And still now, it's very difficult to speak about this.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Aaron Glantz in Erbil, Iraq.
As many as seven people are dead in Venezuela after a week of violent clashes between opposition demonstrators and National Guard troops ended today. Greg Wilpert reports from Caracas.
Opposition protesters tried to block the capital's major arteries with barricades and confronted National Guard troops who tried to clear the roads with rocks, Molotov cocktails, and gunfire. The balance of the week's activities, which opposition leaders have recognized as unfruitful and which lowered the opposition's support in the polls, left between four and seven dead, dozens wounded, and over 100 arrests. The opposition is now engaged in a negotiation process with the country's National Electoral Council to find a way to rescue apparently fraudulent signatures in the petition for a presidential recall referendum. Meanwhile, government officials reacted to yesterday's resignation of its UN ambassador by saying that he was a career diplomat who never really supported the government of President Chavez and was on his way out anyway. Greg Wilpert reporting for Free Speech Radio News from Caracas, Venezuela.
Mexico's president arrived at President Bush's Crawford Ranch today for a two-day summit expected to focus on border security, deportation, and water issues. Renee Feltz has more from KPFT.
Mexican President Vicente Fox canceled his last visit here 2 years ago when Texas executed a Mexican national, denied his right to contact the Mexican consulate. Bush and Fox's relationship is also strained by Mexico's refusal to back U.S. policy in Iraq. This weekend's summit is meant to build support among Hispanic voters for Bush's re-election campaign. In 2000, Bush garnered 35% of such votes, compared to Vice President Al Gore's 62%. Thursday, Bush said he'd consider pulling back on plans to require visa-carrying Mexicans to be fingerprinted and photographed at the border. Analysts say the procedure would have created tremendous problems and should not be seen as immigration reform. From KPFT in Houston, I'm Renee Feltz for Free Speech Radio News.
The Wisconsin legislature is moving forward on banning same-gendered marriage in the state. Steve Zelaznik reports from WORT.
Shortly after 9 this morning, the State Assembly approved a constitutional amendment to define marriage exclusively between a man and woman. Gay marriage alternatives, like civil unions, would be prohibited. This is the legislature's second attempt to ban gay marriage. This time, though, because they're amending the Constitution, a simple majority of both houses must approve the amendment during two consecutive legislative sessions. The Senate will vote next week. If it passes, both houses will have to vote again next session. If that succeeds, a majority of Wisconsin's voters will have to approve the amendment by referendum to ban gay marriage. Steve Zelaznik, Free Speech Radio News, Madison.
PCB levels are too high in the burning of one of the world's largest stockpiles of chemical weapons in Anniston, Alabama. The tests were performed by Environmental Protection Agency officials and results released yesterday. Craig Williams, director of the Chemical Weapons Working Group, charges the levels are dangerously high for the small rural community.
So they've burned 18,000 plus rockets at the Anniston Chemical Weapons Incinerator and took one trial burn in November, which showed they were out of compliance. So our position is they've been out of compliance the entire time and releasing levels of this type of material directly into that community on a chronic basis since they began last August.
75,000 people live in Anniston. An Army representative said the EPA's permit requirements to destroy 99.999% of the lethal chemicals in the incinerator is mathematically impossible. I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
Today, the Bureau of Labor Statistics released new employment figures suggesting that the increase of jobs has slowed and is not keeping up with the growing labor market. Unions and Democratic lawmakers rallied on Capitol Hill to denounce the outsourcing of jobs and tax breaks those corporations receive. Mitch Jezerich was there and he files this report.
President Bush has said the economy is growing and there are jobs out there, but you know what? It's a long commute to China to get those jobs.
Senate Democratic Minority Leader Tom Daschle spoke to about 250 union officials and workers at a noontime rally on Capitol Hill. The highlight that U.S. corporations have relocated millions of jobs to developing countries, where pay and benefits are substantially lower. Earlier in the morning, Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor Statistics Kathleen Ukoff laid out the new employment data at a Senate hearing. The data on payroll employment shows no significant change in the number of jobs created in February, and its unemployment figure is holding at 5.6%. Wages were also unchanged, but productivity was up at 2.6%. Democratic Senator Jack Reed of Rhode Island questions Commissioner Ukoff about the employment data.
It takes about 125,000 jobs per month just to keep up with population and labor force growth. Does that number seem right to you?
Yes.
Thank you. And how many jobs per month have been created since August of last year?
364,000.
Per month, that would be about 60,000?
Approximately, yes.
60,000. So we're about half of what we need just to keep up with the labor force growth.
You generally need about 125,000 jobs.
It seems now we're replacing fewer jobs than we did after the recession of 1990-91. Is that correct?
Yes.
And that was the notorious jobless recovery. So if that was a jobless recovery, what is this?
In the job market, it is a weak recovery.
On Friday morning, the Senate Democratic Policy Committee held a hearing on the outsourcing of jobs. These policy hearings have no Republican participation and rarely are conservatives asked to testify. One witness was David Doolittle of Greenville, Michigan. Doolittle has worked at the Electrolux refrigerator plant for the past 23 years, but that's about to end as the plant that has 2,700 workers in Greenville is about to relocate to Mexico.
That's because the hourly wage in Mexico is at $1.57 and a total wage benefit package would be $3.64. At the Greenville plant, our hourly wage is $15. And the company spends $5.75 in benefits and $2.24 in taxes. In the spring, Walmart is planning to break ground at a new store in Greenville. It is likely some of the folks will lose their that will lose their jobs at Electrolux will work at Walmart. If so, this will mean going from jobs that pay $15 an hour with health care and dental insurance and good defined benefit pension plans to a job that pays $8 an hour and have inadequate health care insurance and no guaranteed pension benefits.
Not everyone at today's hearing blasted corporations for the outsourcing of jobs. Nobel laureate Ralph Gomery, the president of the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, has been influential in the computer industry. Gomery says it's the nature of the markets that requires companies to open shop overseas.
Corporations, as they are constituted today in the United States, their first duty is A, to stay alive, and B, to make a profit for their shareholders. And I've seen enough of corporations to know that when they open an account in China, they know that if they do not, and their competitors do, they won't be around very long.
There is a measure in Congress to decrease the economic incentives for corporations to relocate their plant overseas. The measure in the Senate by Democrat Christopher Dodd of Connecticut has already been weakened by amendments from Republican Senators John McCain of Arizona and Mitch McConnell of Kentucky. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Mitch Jezerich on Capitol Hill.
It's been 3 years since farm workers in southern Florida began a boycott against the fast food giant Taco Bell. After last year's 10-day hunger strike in front of the corporation's headquarters failed to produce negotiations with a company, the workers decided to take a different approach. They have crossed the country on business and marched from Los Angeles to Irvine to communicate their message directly to the people in the streets. From outside Irvine, Shannon Young files this report.
The 44-mile march to Taco Bell's corporate headquarters kicked off on Tuesday morning in East Los Angeles. Organized by the Florida Farm Worker Advocacy Group, the Coalition of Immokalee Workers, the 4-day march is yet another action in the 3-year boycott against the fast food giant. 2 busloads of coalition members left southern Florida on February 25th on their way to Louisville, Kentucky, home to Taco Bell's parent company, Yum Brands. Dubbed the Taco Bell Truth Tour, the cross-country road trip is aimed at pressuring the corporation to improve working conditions in the Florida fields that supply the tomatoes at their nationwide franchises.
We have 3 demands.
Member of the Coalition of Immokalee Workers, Gerardo Reyes Chavez.
One is a dialogue of 3 parts between Taco Bell, the growers that produce the tomato that Taco Bell use every day, and the representatives of the Coalition of Immokalee Workers. The next demand is 1 penny more per pound coming from Taco Bell under a contract that will increase the wages almost a double, because farm workers have received the same wages for over 20 years, and we are asking something to put this at the level of the inflation. The 3rd demand will be a code of conduct that will ensure that no violations of human rights are happening in the fields where the tomatoes that Taco Bell is buying are being produced.
Tomato pickers in southern Florida receive the same wages today as they did in 1978, 40 cents for every 32-pound bucket of tomatoes. This means that in order to make $50 in one day, a farm worker must pick 4,000 pounds of tomatoes. Although Taco Bell has stated that they are not responsible for the work conditions in the fields owned by the third-party suppliers, their website features a guarantee that all animals used in Taco Bell food receive humane treatment. Co-founder of the United Farm Workers of America, Dolores Huerta, joined the march in its 2nd day and provided this context for the Taco Bell boycott.
I think that this effort is very sustained, and it's been going on a long time. They haven't given up, and they brought the struggle outside from Florida to California and to the United States of America, and basically that's exactly what they need to do. This is exactly what we did with the United Farm Workers. We took our struggle from Delano throughout the country, and we were able to get people to support our boycott. We were boycotting the stores, and we asked people not to eat grapes, and it worked, and this is how we got all of our contracts. Without the boycott, it never would have happened.
Most of the farm workers in Immokalee have migrated from Mexico, Central America, and Haiti. Anuradha Mittal of Food First points out the role of globalization and trade agreements as elements behind the labor dispute.
Family farmers in countries like Mexico are being displaced from land as they cannot compete with subsidized cheap grain that is dumped from the United States. And these are the family farmers who are forced to leave their lands. It is estimated that almost 600 family farmers are displaced from land in Mexico each day. And these are the communities who then try to cross the border, hoping to find a living wage, a life of dignity, and all they find is incarceration at the border, death at the border, or slavery in the fields of Immokalee. So when we join and march with the Coalition of Immokalee Workers, it's really a struggle about all the working poor, whether it is in Canada or United States or Mexico, who have been displaced because of free trade agreements.
While several people are visibly limping from sore muscles and swollen ankles, musicians like Lila Downs, Tom Morello, and Boots Riley from The Coup will likely have people dancing in spite of blistered feet. Coalition members have expressed their determination to carry on with the strike until Taco Bell agrees to meet at the negotiating table. In Santa Ana, California, I'm Shannon Young for Free Speech Radio News.
Last November, President Bush signed the first ever federal ban on abortion procedures called the Partial Birth Abortion Act. Pro-choice organizations quickly sought and won a restraining order to prevent the ban's enforcement and are asking the court to issue a permanent injunction. A federal court in San Francisco heard testimony today. FSRN correspondent Sarah Turner heard from advocates on both sides.
Planned Parenthood has received subpoenas from the Justice Department for hundreds of confidential medical records from patients across the country.
Elizabeth Toledo is Vice President of Communications for Planned Parenthood Federation of America. She says the Justice Department is overstepping the law in seeking to obtain private medical information. But the DOJ's position is that access to these files is necessary in order to determine whether so-called partial birth abortions are ever medically necessary.
This legislation that we are fighting now in court would impede doctors from being able to provide the best medical care and would prevent women everywhere from being able to choose the best medical options for them. And this has also mostly been about rhetoric than about medicine. Even the term of the legislation is a politically contrived term. It doesn't come out of the medical community.
In addition to Planned Parenthood's records, the Justice Department has subpoenaed patient information from abortion practitioners and from at least five hospitals. The DOJ says privacy concerns are irrelevant because personal information will be blacked out. But David Selden, communications director for NARAL Pro-Choice America, doesn't trust Ashcroft to protect anyone's privacy. He believes the ban won't stand up to a constitutional challenge because it doesn't protect the health of the woman.
41 states have bans on post-viability abortion with exceptions for cases where the woman's health is in jeopardy. The law the president signed is not only the first federal law criminalizing abortion ever, they refuse to include the kind of health exception that courts have consistently said is required.
The U.S. Department of Justice declined to comment due to the ongoing nature of this litigation. They did, however, refer FSRN to an organization said to represent the government's position.
This is Jay Sekulow, new statewide efforts to protect the unborn.
Jay Sekulow live from inside the nation's capital and all across America, chief counsel of the American Center for Law and Justice.
The Christian Conservative Center for Law and Justice is an overtly anti-abortion group, which bankrolls lawsuits seeking to undermine Roe v. Wade. Its chief counsel, Jay Sekulow, speaks daily on over 500 radio stations.
Partial birth abortion procedure is never necessary, either for the health of the mother or for the life of the mother. And again, this is going to be critical evidence that will be used ultimately, hopefully, to persuade the Supreme Court of the United States.
Vicky Saporta, president of the National Abortion Federation, is concerned that if the partial birth abortion ban is deemed constitutional, a woman's right to choose would be in danger.
This is a premise that they've wanted to establish for many years in order to use it as a means to overturn Roe v. Wade.
David Selden agrees and is organizing a huge pro-choice march in Washington, D.C., April 25th.
People have a hard time believing that we can lose rights once they're granted in this country, but we are perilously close to losing the right to choose in the United States. If George Bush is reelected, it will be very difficult to maintain that right.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Sarah Turner in Washington, D.C.
Working on the premise that biological weapons pose a genuine threat to the health of military personnel, a committee convened by the Institute of Medicine and the National Research Council has written a report called Giving Full Measure to Countermeasures. The report, requested by the Department of Defense, recommends that the DOD establish a medical biodefense agency. In the second part of her series on biowarfare and biodefense, Kalia Ramirez asks if such an agency would sacrifice medical ethics at the altar of medical countermeasures.
The committee wants its proposed medical biodefense agency to form effective partnerships with academia and with biotechnology and pharmaceutical companies. The agency's success will hinge on DOD's ability to meet potential partners' concerns about such things as the size of the market, liability risks, and bureaucracy. The report suggests offering incentives to the private sector such as, quote, the relaxation of acquisition procedures, expedited peer review, and market guarantees. Would incentives to the private sector end up being a boondoggle that would not provide the troops with adequate protections in return?
One of the problems that the Defense Department has in this area is the fact that the pharmaceutical companies aren't interested in it.
Dr. Jack Gansler was Undersecretary of Defense for Acquisition, Technology, and Logistics during the second Clinton administration.
This is a very small market, and it's highly regulated because of the normal way the Defense Department does its business. It has minimum profit relative to the commercial market, and so forth. So it's unattractive to the pharmaceutical companies. And one of the things that was needed was to try to create some way in which they'd even be interested.
The report states that, quote, most medical biodefense countermeasures are likely to receive FDA approval under the animal efficacy rule and thus without direct evidence of efficacy in humans, unquote. Does this mean that being a guinea pig is now part of military life?
Well, I would not say that's true.
Leslie Z. Bennett, who chaired the committee, is a professor of pharmaceutical sciences at the University of California at San Francisco.
I think it's the perspective that anyone takes. I think there is a potential that the president can do anything. And that's the way the laws are written. I didn't write that law. So I do not think that this is a part of being in the military is that you're a guinea pig.
Joyce Riley, RN, spokesperson for the American Gulf War Veterans Association, disagrees.
We still have a presidential executive order in effect, 13139, that says that anybody can be given anything in the military as long as the president or the Secretary of Defense orders it.
Dr. Bob Gould of Physicians for Social Responsibility says medical ethics would be compromised in a race to develop biodefense countermeasures.
The way they frame the argument is that we just have to make this way to produce these countermeasures and vaccines more efficient. In the entire 110-page report, I think I spotted one paragraph in either Chapter 1 or Chapter 2 that says, well, you have to build in some way to deal with the ethics of this sort of thing.
The committee recommends that liability be limited so that the government would be the sole defendant in any suit alleging injury in connection with a designated biodefense countermeasure. But as Professor Bennett acknowledges, soldiers have no legal cause of action against the United States government for injuries related to their military service.
Well, the committee had nothing to do with this, but certainly the law as written doesn't allow that. But that committee has nothing to do with that, and we can't make any recommendations about that. I mean, we could make recommendations, but that had nothing to do with the development of medical countermeasures.
Given the possible dispersal of a pathogen, Dr. Gansler says using available biological countermeasures is more ethical than not using them while waiting for the full licensure process to unfold.
Which is more unethical, to give them something that you have a high probability to work because you've done animal modeling and enough testing on it to think that it might both be safe and effective, versus waiting until 12 years to find out while all the troops die?
Dr. Art Kaplan, chair of the Department of Medical Ethics at the University of Pennsylvania, thinks that medical ethics require compensating troops and their families if countermeasures go awry.
I don't see enough attention being paid to the ethics of experimentation in, let's call it, military warfare and bioterrorism circumstances. The basic idea is let's get the policies in place that allow us to do what we can, but not really debate informed consent, the rights of soldiers, the right to compensation, what are the obligations of those who would put untested or things only tested on the animals into play in terms of follow-up, short-term and long-term. Are we doing what we should, in other words, to basically set in an ethical infrastructure, even in the context of war and terror?
For FSRN, I'm Kelia Ramirez.
The first conference on birth registration in Central and West Africa was held in Senegal's capital, Dakar, last month. The UN says that at present, 70% of children on the African continent don't have their names, nationality, or identity recorded. In Senegal, where the conference, organized by human rights groups, including UNICEF, was held, only 50% of all births are registered. Many believe that this has led to low schooling rates and youth unemployment, both of which affect the economy. In Senegal, Ndjaga Sek has more.
Nous sommes partis dans les villages, nous avons recensé d'abord les enfants qui ne sont pas enregistrés, qui ne sont pas déclarés.
We've been to villages to list the children who weren't registered before talking to the populations. They said they didn't have the information. Some would say their parents or grandparents weren't declared themselves. So what's the use of declaring their children when everybody knows they are their children?
That was Tunkara Tambake, coordinator of African Movement of Children and Young Workers, speaking at the first West and Central African Regional Conference on Birth Registration in Dakar. Organized jointly by UNICEF, Plan International and UN Fund for Population Activities, or UNFPA, bringing together 180 delegates from 24 African countries, registrars and the press people to examine ideas of improving birth registration systems. In sub-Saharan Africa, 17 million children are not registered, which is one child out of four, with fewer girls registered than boys. Regional UNICEF officer Abdullahi Sajo says that birth registration is fundamental in a child's development.
Birth registration is necessary for the realization of a number of children's rights. First, the right to a name, the right to a nationality, the right to protection from trafficking. For example, as you know, trafficking, child trafficking, is a hard issue now in our region. The right to be enrolled to school, the right to get an identity, the right to voting, and so on.
In 2000, 50 million children were born without a birth registration. These children are prime targets to child trafficking, and children comprise the bulk of many rebel armies involved with conflicts in Africa. They are also subjected to child labor in cotton and cocoa fields in West Africa. Many also are victims of wars causing their papers to burn. As a result, they are denied health care, an identity, citizenship, an education, and some economic amenities. 100,000 children are homeless in Dakar. Many parents don't ensure the civil act of registering their child out of ignorance, poverty, or mere negligence. John Chalamer, Plan International Regional Officer, explains.
One girl said, no, I don't have a certificate of birth because my father used the document like a piece of newspaper to make a cigarette. Another child said, my father's afraid to go before the local authorities and ask for a certificate.
The number of children unregistered varies from a country to another. Togo has 20%, Chad 66%, and 75% in the Gambia. The situation is more appalling in rural areas where children work on farms. Many face difficulty in affording the $6 required to pay for registering children. According to some, the 48 African countries who ratified the Conventions on Children's Rights in 1990 have made very little effort in adhering to those ratifications. Amimbo is the manager of Ampire, a boarding house for homeless children in Dakar. It's too theoretical. Actions speak louder than words. The laws are passed, but if they aren't implemented, and we sit and watch, things go upside down, and we will face the same problems as in Dakar. We would like the government to act. We've got enough of the theory. During the conference, the United Nations tried to fulfill the agreements set by African heads of states in 2003 in Bamako on protecting children. To set the example, Senegal has authorized the period of March to June for gratuitous child registration. The message was echoed at a mega concert by singers like Harry Belafonte and singers from West and Central Africa to start mass sensitization. In Senegal, this is Njagasek for Free Speech Radio News.
You are listening to Free Speech Radio News. Free Speech Radio News was produced at Pacifica stations KPFA, KPFK, WBAI and community radio station WMNF. For more information or to visit our news archive, visit the website www.fsrn.org. I'm Amma Nsiabwadi.